Ladies and gentlemen, introducing your host in the Champions Corner, a bodybuilding and MMA expert with an unbroken, undefeated truth-telling record of 500-0. Returning to the cage for another MMA pep talk with the unvarnished, brutally honest truth on the state of mixed martial arts, the General of the Truth Army, the creator and master of the devastating art of pep jitsu, and the reigning, defending, pound-for-pound MMA analysis champion, Larry the Truth Pepe!
Hello, my friends, and Happy New Year to the Truth Army. Well, I did not expect that we would be getting together for another MMA pep talk this soon after the last one, but these are unique times, and a lot has happened in just the couple of days since we did the last one. When we did the last one, basically what we had to work off of was the announcement that there was a positive test for the M3 metabolite for John Jones. We were told in an embedded video where Dana White broke the news to Alexander Gustafsson that John had had 8 drug tests in 6 months and they were negative, and that only one was positive in that time frame, the December test earlier this month. Turns out that is not true. Turns out that John failed 3 tests over that time frame, not one. So we will get to that. And perhaps certainly more importantly, in the interim between our last episode and now, Jeff Nowitzki, who has clearly taken the lead for the UFC on this as the point man, if you will, he was there when Dana told Gustafsson about the one failed test that we now know is 3. He also did a 2-hour appearance with Joe Rogan on his podcast, going through what he called the science and the experts and the theories, some of which I don't agree with at all and I think is somewhat misleading and in some cases flat out wrong. So we're going to get to that in a little bit as well. And we also had Mark Raimondi did an excellent article on MMA fighting, which really was good reporting, if you will, with the facts. He was able to get the letters or excerpts from the letters of the various experts that the UFC and USADA are relying on for the opinion that this metabolite could be in your system, in John's system, for a 17-month period. So we will get into that, but that was helpful from a factual standpoint of getting some of that information. So let's, I think, start with John's failed tests. But before we get into that timeline, I think there's a very important distinction that is not being made out there, and I think it's not being made on purpose. So you're hearing a lot, and I've had people write to me and say, you know, how come I hear people talking about 1 picogram and then I see 60 picograms, but every time I hear somebody talk about it, they're talking about 1 picogram. First off, here's a very important point, I think, and that is that this is picograms per milliliter. Now, John has never had a test, at least not that they have reported, where there was 1 picogram. He's had 3 positive tests this year for the M3 metabolite, and they came in at 8, 19, and 60. And we'll get to the specifics in a moment. But that doesn't mean that that's how much was in the whole sample. That is picograms per milliliter. And according to the USADA website, they get a 90 milliliter sample and test 60 milliliters of it. So that means that when you hear everybody say single digit and double digit, he hasn't had a single test that has been single or double digit. It's been single or double digit per milliliter. You have to times that by 60 to get how many actual picograms of the M3 metabolite, derivative of turinabol, are actually in that one sample. Now, that's not necessarily what's in his entire body. That's just what's in that one sample. So when you hear about a 60 picogram per milliliter test that he failed, that sample, that one sample, doesn't have 60. It has 3,600. So I just want to make that point because I really haven't seen it anywhere. And I think it's a misleading way to make the numbers much smaller than they actually are in the actual sample. Now, let's get to the test results. If we go back to 2017, because that's really where this all starts, on July 6th and July 7th, John takes two tests, both of which come back clean. And everything I talk about today is going to be strictly with respect to this M3 metabolite, because that's really the only thing that's at issue when it comes to John's tests. And so July 6th and July 7th, there is no presence of the metabolite. On July 28th, according to the arbitrator's report, the reading came in between 20 and 80 picograms, 20 to 80. Since there is no threshold, meaning for this particular substance, which is a banned substance under the code, no question about that, there is no threshold. So if you have any of it in your system, you fail. It's not like what we've seen with marijuana, for example, where if you're above or below a certain number, you may or may not have a violation. This is a strict liability, can't have any of it in your system. So if you did have one picogram, you fail. So they put his level at 20 to 80 because the arbitrator report said they didn't have to identify the specificity of the number because it is a zero tolerance substance. So July 28th, 20 to 80. So we don't know exactly where, but again, 20 to 80 in the sample means 1,200 to 4,800 picograms in that one urine sample. Then he was not tested from October of 2017 to August of 2018. So that is a 10-month period of time. And when asked about that, Jeff Nowitzki in a scrum said that, you know, he doesn't get involved in the testing, but that, you know, he assumed it was kind of an allocation of resources type of thing since John was on the sidelines, etc. That is ridiculous. The idea that a drug testing organization, USADA, does approximately 2,500 drug tests a year, and someone who has failed two drug tests in the middle of all that being decided is somehow not tested for 10 months is mind-blowing to me. But it is what it is. They did not test him from October of 2017 to August of 2018. And the reason I bring that up as well is because we have no values to look at over that extended period of time. He gets tested on August 9th of this year, does not have any of the M3 metabolite in his system. Then on August 29th, he's tested, and he has 8 picograms per milliliter, so that would translate to 480. And that is now 396 days, as best I can calculate. If I'm off by a day in either direction, I apologize. But that is 396 days after his original failure on July 28th of 17. So it's been quite some time, and we have one test, only one test, since they gave him off for 10 months, in early August where it's not there. Then he gets tested again on September 18th, roughly 3 weeks later, fails that one as well, and has 19 picograms per milliliter, so that's 1,140 in the sample. Then he does four consecutive tests after that, September 21, October 2, October 11, and November 14th, all negative for the M3 metabolite. And then comes back on December 9th and fails again for the M3 metabolite, this time bumping to 60 picograms per milliliter, which is 3,600. And that is, again, give or take a day, 499 days from his July 28th, 17 failure initially that started this whole thing roughly a year and a half ago. The thing that kind of jumps out at me is that the test result from 2017 and 2018, if you notice, are virtually identical. Depending on where you put that July 17 test where he came in between 20 and 80, the December 9th test of this year was at 60. It's virtually identical, which means if you believe their theory that this is remnants of the M3 metabolite from almost 500 days ago that popped him again on December 9th, that tested him positive again on December 9th, that virtually nothing has changed in his body with no new ingestion in 17 months. No change, which would really be against any notion of common sense or science, in my opinion. So the critical question, quite frankly, maybe the only question that you need to decide when you analyze this is very simple. Is there scientific evidence that the ingestion from 2017 could stay in his system for approximately 500 days and cause him to test positive again that long after the initial positive back in 17? That's the question. Because if the answer to that question is no, if there is no science that truly backs up that that substance can stay in his body for 17 months, for almost 500 days, then this is a doping violation, plain and simple. So that's the question we have to answer. So you remember when we did the pep talk last week that one of the things I was jumping up and down about was that when Nowitzki and Dana did this announcement about the card moving and John being positive again, but everything was okay because the experts and the science, all these broad terms with no specificity, like what experts, what exactly do they say, what does the science say, what studies are there, what do they say, we got none of that. So I was glad when he went on with Rogan and he cited and explained what he called the science, which is a study by Tim Sobolevsky and Grigory Rodchenkov. And if that second name sounds familiar, it is because he is the central main character in the Icarus documentary that you can find on Netflix. It was excellent. And, of course, it involves the whole Russian doping program that ultimately got them booted from the 2018 Olympics. And Rodchenkov was one of the key scientists involved in that whole thing. So he's the central figure in Icarus. Well, he's the one who actually did this study. And the study is called, if you want to Google it, Detection and Mass Spectrometric Characterization of Novel Long-Term Dehydrochloromethyl Testosterone Metabolites in Human Urine. That long name I just gave you is the chemical name for turinabol, and so turinabol metabolites. So that's what the study was about. And ironically, 150 samples were analyzed, and they determined detection times. Now, when I heard Novitzky talking about this study, he made 3 points. Well, 2 points clearly, and the other one, maybe he made clearly, maybe I missed it, maybe it was just inferential, but this is the study that he is citing as the science for the proposition, because this is the only question we have to answer, can this M3 metabolite from 500 days ago cause the positive on December 9th? That's the whole question we're talking about. So the first point he made was that this is the only study, so in essence, this is the science. I agree with him completely. And forget about whether I agree with him. Every expert that I could find says this is the only study that has determined detection times for the M3 metabolite. But this study didn't just determine detection times for the M3 metabolite. They actually discovered the M3 metabolite. So I agree with him completely that this is the science. He also made a comment very strongly, because it would support part of their position, that the short and long-term metabolites, so let me break it down this way. Let's use M1, M2, and M3. M3 is the long-term metabolite that John tested positive for. M1 and M2 are shorter slash medium metabolites, if you will. But the longest term is M3. So that's the one that's going to stay in there the longest. The M1 and M2, Jeff used the argument that because they were not present in any of John's tests, that was evidence that there was no recent usage. Because, he said, that they stay in the system for at least 22 days. That is not accurate. I am going to read you, and I'm going to tell you why it's very important. I'm going to read you word for word from the study. Quote, our study has shown that the metabolite M3 and to a lesser extent its epimer and M4 are the most long-term metabolites of DHCMT. Taking into account that 1 and 2 are reportedly detectable up to 22 days post-administration, and that the relative concentration of M3 in DHCMT post-administration urines is normally higher compared to 1 and 2, the detection window of M3 could be estimated at 40 to 50 days, et cetera, et cetera. Two important critical points in this. It's not that they are in there for a minimum of 22 days. It's that they are in there for up to 22 days. And the reason that that's important is because when you go back and you look at John's tests, and you look at the test on 8-9, where there's nothing present, and then on 8-29, M3 is there, but M1 and M2 aren't. Novitzky uses this argument to say, well, if he took it on the 9th, and now you add the minimum 22 days, when he tested on the 29th, the short and medium would have had to have been present. But that's wrong, because it's up to 22 days. That means that M1 and M2 could be gone in a matter of a day or two, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. The max is 22, not the minimum. So that argument fails mathematically. And it's of an important distinction, because a lot of what they're relying on to say that there's no new ingestion is that there's no short or medium M1 or M2 metabolite because of this 22-day window. But it's up to, so that window does not prove that point at all. The other important thing from this, and I think it is the most important thing from this, is that the detection window of M3 is estimated at 40 to 50 days. What that means is that from the time you take the turinabol, the detection window, when you're going to test and find the M3 for doping purposes, Rodchenkov and Sobolevsky, who discovered the M3 metabolite, these are the people who found it, who discovered it, and then who tested its removal rate, its excretion rate, set that number at a 50-day maximum. 50. Not 499, not 500, but 50. Even if we say they were off by 100% and it's 100 days, we're still 400 days short, roughly. So that doesn't make any sense to me. If that's your proof, if that's the science, and we all agree that that's the science, that is not a study that favors the conclusion that the M3 metabolite was from 500 days ago. That would bring you to the conclusion, this study would bring you to the conclusion that there had to be a new ingestion because they set the maximum time at 40 to 50 days. Now, we're going to dig into that a little bit more in a second, but I do want to say one thing. I don't want anyone to take anything I'm saying that I have any opinion at all whether John Jones intentionally took something, accidentally took something else and thought that this wasn't in it. I don't have the faintest idea. Quite frankly, there's one person in the whole world who knows the answer to that question, and that's John Jones. There is no way for me to tell you, no way for anyone to tell you, quite frankly, that he was popping oral turinabol in his mouth like candy, or did he get it from a contaminated supplement? Did he think he was taking X and he ended up taking something that had oral turinabol? I have no idea, nor do I have an opinion about it, but it doesn't matter because under the code, if it's in your system in any amount, that is a doping violation. And what they're trying to do is say, no, 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 this is from 500 days ago. And this study clearly does not support that at all. In fact, it would have to bring you to the opposite conclusion. So now let's make our way over to the experts, because you say, well, wait, if the study doesn't prove it, and it doesn't at all. In fact, I could throw a scenario at you. He tested negative for everything on August 9th. Let's just say, hypothetically, that on August 10th, turinabol got in his system. Again, I don't know how. I don't know if he took it. I don't know if it was in a... I don't have the faintest idea. But let's just say on August 10th, it got in his system. Well, M1 and M2 could be out of his system in a matter of days. So if he took it on the 10th, 19 days later, when he tested on the 29th, it would not have to be in his system at all, M1 and M2, but M3 would be, because that would be within the window. And on September 18th, which would be roughly 5 weeks later, still squarely within the M3 window, it would also make sense that M1 and M2 would be gone from the August 10th administration, and M3 would still be in his system. So my point is that there is a plausible mathematical scenario that I can come up with just looking at the dates and looking at the science. The opposite conclusion is not possible based on the study that everybody agrees is the one and only study, the only true science about the very metabolite that John tested positive for a total of four times. Once back in 17, three times in 18. Now, so you say, okay, what do the experts say? Because they're the experts. Well, the first expert on what I'll call the pro-USADA side is Daniel Eichner, who runs the WADA laboratory in Utah. I should mention, since nobody else is, that he used to work at USADA. He is the former science director of USADA. So there is a relationship there. Now, I'm not saying it disqualifies him. I'm saying you have to take everything into consideration when you are analyzing competing expert opinion, if you will. He wrote a letter that says there is no evidence that DHCMT has been readministered, end quote. Now, what's interesting is that if you hear people not named Eichner talk about it, they say that he said there's been no new ingestion. He said there's no evidence that it's been readministered. He is not definitively saying that it couldn't have been. But let's keep moving. He says the most likely cause of the long-term metabolite of the steroid tarinabol still being in Jones' system was due to, quote, residual levels from a previous exposure. Okay, so previous when? Notice, again, I don't have the whole letter. I'm working off of Ramondi's piece, but that's the quote. Well, previous exposure when? Previous exposure in August? Previous exposure 500 days ago? Because here's what's interesting. What's interesting is his opinion must have evolved because he was singing a different tune. In May 2016, which is just 2.5 years ago, he was quoted in a story on ESPN regarding drug busts in Major League Baseball, and I'm quoting him, "The window of detection has moved out to typically several weeks, and in some rare circumstances, up to months after administration." Months and 17 months, I don't think that's what he meant. So in 2016, this expert said specifically that the M3 metabolite was detectable for weeks and in rare circumstances, months after administration. Another expert that they have brought out is Larry Bowers, who is also a former USADA employee. And he was less definitive and said that John had not ingested anything new from August 2018 to December 2018. So he's not saying that it came from the 2017 test. He's just saying that he doesn't think John took anything new in from August to December of this year. And then he says, "I cannot exclude the possibility that the December 9, 2018 result arose from an exposure before July 2017. Cannot exclude the possibility. That's as definitive as he's willing to be. And then the third expert, currently is the USADA science director. And he says, quote, "In this case, the detection of the single long-term M3 metabolite at the tail end of the detection window and combined with the aforementioned factors makes detection challenging, so a pattern of detection in some samples and absent in others is not uncommon." Tail end of the detection window, if he's talking about 17 months, there is nowhere in what everyone agrees is, quote, the science, which is that study, that suggests that that detection window can be 17 months long. But here's what I find interesting as well. Frank Mir tested positive for the exact same thing. Now, we know he tested positive in the spring of 2016. I'm assuming that either Mr. Fedoruk, who is the current USADA science director, or Mr. Bowers, who was the one before him, I believe. I don't know what dates they worked. I don't know their employment histories. But I assume one of them was in charge when Frank failed his test. But he was apparently sung a different tune. I'm quoting Mir now. In the spring of 2016, when USADA representatives sat in my Las Vegas kitchen and told me that the tarinabol metabolite that they said I tested positive for could only have been ingested within a window of the past several months, I vehemently proclaimed my innocence. Now, let me stop. Past several months would be completely consistent with the science of the one study that everybody agrees is the only study regarding this metabolite and detection time. Back to Mir. Quote, I vehemently proclaim my innocence. Having never failed any drug test throughout my career, I asked if we could go back further in the past to test my supplements that I could have taken, but they claimed that was both impossible and unnecessary. They were firm on their association that there was only a recent period of several months that would warrant any consideration. Now, little more than 2 years later, John Jones has tested positive for the same trace of the same banned substance, and USADA is taking the position that this same low level is in fact not a new ingestion, but something that could be the result of a residual pulsing effect that could potentially stay in his system forever. Further, they are now claiming that this phenomenon is something they are seeing in other cases as well. End quote. So you can understand, here's the thing that strikes me. He's consistently being told in these conversations, according to him, that the detection window, that the relevant time frame is the past couple of months. And quite frankly, based on the study, that's exactly what they should have been telling him. The question is, what's changed? Now, on the other side of the ledger, I would argue that we have a couple of other experts. One of them is often referred to as the godfather of anti-doping, and that is Don Catlin. He is the WADA lab director in Los Angeles. He said that the M3 metabolite detection period is 40 to 50 days, maybe longer. I'm guessing, I don't know Mr. Catlin, I haven't spoken to him, I'm guessing by maybe longer, he didn't mean 10 to 12 times longer. But, you know, I can't speak for him, but you can draw your own conclusions. Oliver Catlin, who is another anti-doping expert, his son, I believe, and president of the Banned Substances Control Group, said about the Rodchenkov study, quote, it is the seminal publication on detection of oral tarinabol. The seminal publication. You know why? Because it's the only thing out there. It is the only science. So he is validating that. And then, last but not least, I would argue that your third expert is Rodchenkov himself, who discovered the M3 metabolite, said that it had a 40 to 50 day window of detection. But then, because that study was done approximately seven years ago, I think it was 2011, 2012. Well, I mentioned the Icarus documentary and that he was at the heart of the Russian doping and everything else. And the World Anti-Doping Agency McLaren report, Richard McLaren, who oversaw that investigation and so on, I happened to find a sworn, signed affidavit of Grigory Rodchenkov from that proceeding. Now, keep in mind, it is sworn under penalty of perjury. So if anything in that affidavit is inaccurate or not the best of his truth, he can go to jail. And this is what he said. Keep in mind, this is approximately 13 months ago, 14 months ago now. This is what he said. And I'm quoting, speaking about the M3 metabolite. Quote, at the end of 2010, a lab analyst in Moscow found other troubling news for our doping program, that oral turinabol, another favorite PED for Russian athletes, can be detected through identification of its long-term metabolites. He learned that it was retained in athletes' body for longer than expected, and the detection window during urine analysis was enlarged from approximately 1 week to approximately 5 months. So he himself has upped the estimate, the detection window, if you will, to 5 months. That's 150 days. We're still 349 days shy of that December test. Still 300 and almost a full year shy of that test. So I would argue it is up to you to draw to your conclusions. Do you believe what the study says? What the person who found the metabolite and did the study says? What Don Catlin says? Or do you think we should disregard the study and simply take the opinions of the two previous USADA employees and the current USADA employee? Up for you to decide, but I believe the study, because all we keep being told is the science, the science, the science. Well, the science says what it says. And based on that science, I don't see how you can come to the conclusion. And apparently, neither do Rodchenkov or Caitlin, that 500 days later, an ingestion of turinabol that produces the M3 metabolite can be responsible for the same thing. Especially when you consider that the amount is identical. Virtually identical. It could be even be more. But 20 to 80 and then 60, 17 months later, that would suggest that virtually nothing exited John's body in that entire time. And that's a little hard for me to envision, especially in light of the science. Now I want to move on to the clomiphene argument, the pulsing argument that Google hasn't heard of, I hadn't heard of, don't know too many people who had. But the idea behind the pulsing is that the argument they're putting out is that you can have circumstances where you have positives, then somebody tests clean and then tests positive again, but it's not from a new administration, new ingestion, but it's the for some reason the substance kind of appears, reappears. That's quote-unquote what they're referring to as pulsing. And Novitsky cites a clomiphene study for that proposition. Number one, I would say that that is irrelevant because it is not oral turinabol, let alone the M3 metabolite derived from oral turinabol. So it is a different drug with a different chemical composition, and in my eyes, it would not make the point that because one drug pulses, another drug pulses. That is simply not the case if you agree with the pulsing concept at all. The second thing is the study was stopped at 261 days. So even if you saw that, whether that would be proof or evidence, if you will, that at almost 500 days that phenomenon could be happening with a different drug is a stretch, I would say. But here's the thing that is actually more interesting. I went back and looked at that study, and when you look at the actual value results on the study, they didn't come up clean. as is suggested. See, in John's case, his M3 was 0, and then it was 8 and 19, and then a bunch of zeros again, and then 60. So keep in mind, there were 5 out of 8 tests that were 0, meaning it's not here, period. In this case, there were no zeros. There was what's called limit of detection, which they defined as less than 50 picograms. So if it came in at less than 50 picograms, it was entered into their chart as LOD, limit of detection. That is not zero. That means you're not getting a reading over 50 picograms. So if you're putting it forth for the notion that you can have alternating positives and negatives, limited detection in this study was not a negative. It was not zero. It was less than 50 picograms. That's not the same. I mean, even if you look at just John's case specifically, 2 of his positives would have been LODs if they followed the same methodology, because this was 50 picograms, and let's say they used that same number on his. He had a test at 9 and a test at 18. So those two would have been showing up as LOD or limit of detection. So it is not apples for apples, oranges for oranges. So I believe that whole clomiphene study is not supportive of the position that they want to use it for, and it's on a completely different drug. So I would truly deem that whole argument as irrelevant. I would also make the argument to you that Dr. Eichner, who I mentioned earlier, and John's own expert at the California State Athletic Commission hearing, Mr. Scott, both would defeat this theory through their testimony. They both, back in February of this year, when John's license got pulled and he got fined, they both said that the turinabol would have had to have been administered after his July 7 negative test was clean, and then in between that and his July 28th positive test. They both agreed that would have had to have been when it came in his body. They didn't say whether it was intentional or not, but they said that's when it would have had to come in his body. If pulsing with turinabol and the M3 metabolite were a thing, then arguably he would not have had to have taken it between July 7th and July 28th, because if the pulsing argument holds, he could have taken it a week before, pulsed, I'm putting this in air quotes because I don't believe it, pulsed, and the July 7th test could have come back clean when it was in his system. It could have been hiding, and then it could have reappeared for the July 28th test. So I put no stock in this pulsing argument at all. All right, a couple of other arguments they made. No performance-enhancing effect. This is irrelevant and unprovable. Of course, they're going with the notion that it's such a small amount, it couldn't have helped him at all, et cetera, et cetera. Again, I will just raise quickly, not that it's a big amount, but a 60 picogram per milliliter measurement is actually 3,600 picograms in that one sample, which is not indicative of the whole body. By the way, trace amounts found in the body of something does not mean that trace amounts were taken. It's all a question of timing. And you don't find massive amounts of drugs in the system on drug tests generally. So I think it's an irrelevant argument. I think it's an unprovable. The reason it's irrelevant is because there's nothing in the code that says that something has to be performance enhancing. Either it's there and you fail, or it's not and you don't. It's this. The code is not complicated in that respect. They also make the adipose tissue argument. Zero evidence of this, literally. Zero. That the M3 may be hidden in the fat tissues. And Nowitzki makes the argument that maybe John was starting to train when the first failure happened back in August because maybe he was hoping for or getting word that there might be, or however he phrased it, a positive result when John went to arbitration, and maybe when he started to train, then that the fat tissues were going down, so it came out of his fat tissues. And then he tested positive again a couple of weeks out from the fight when he would be training hard. I brought this up last time. John is not someone who carries much body fat at all. Number two, there is no evidence whatsoever that I'm aware of or that they have brought forward that the M3 metabolite hides in the fatty tissue like, for example, a heavy oil injectable like a decadurobilin or an Equipoise. So this argument, quite frankly, has absolutely no merit whatsoever. It's just a hypothesis. So I mentioned earlier John's California State Athletic Commission hearing back in February of this year, of 2018, depending on when you're listening to this. It could be 2019 already. And at that hearing, Dr. Eichner was the expert on behalf of the commission or the state, and Mr. Scott was the expert on behalf of John. And Mr. Scott said that he estimated the half-life of the M3 metabolite to be 14 days, and that was confirmed as a reasonable estimate by Dr. Eichner. So you had a situation where they both loosely agreed that the M3 metabolite that John tested positive for has a 14-day half-life. Now, I have no idea where they got that from. I have no idea what the science behind that may or may not be, but that is what they both said. What is fascinating about that is when you do the calculations, and remember from last time, a half-life of a drug, in this case a metabolite, is how long it takes for half of it to come out of your system. So, you know, you do 100 milligrams of something today. If it has a 14-day half-life, then in 14 days, you have 50 milligrams. And 14 days after that, you have 25 milligrams. Well, remember, the half-life of oral turinabol, the drug, is 16 hours. But the metabolite is obviously longer lasting, and they both estimated it at 14 days. So I went back and did the math. I started at 80 picograms, the highest count that we have on any, even estimated count that we have on any John Jones sample. Because remember, the first sample was 20 to 80. So I went with 80 because that gives John the longest amount of time for the M3 metabolite to still be in his system. And what I came up with mathematically, and you're free to do it, is when he took his day 396 test, John had 8 picograms in that sample. And if you half-life every 14 days down to that time frame, he would have had 1/5 millionth of a picogram in his system. He had 8. If you go to his day 417 test, he had 19 picograms. Based on the half-life progression, you would have 1/10 millionth of a picogram. And if you go all the way down to day 499, when he had 60 picograms in his system, in his sample, not in his system, I misspoke, in his sample, I had to go to a conversion tool online to get a fraction of 1/500 millionth of a picogram. Obviously, I'm not being facetious. These are the numbers, but you wouldn't be able to find it when you're getting to a millionth of a picogram. No lab is that sensitive. So my only point is that by both experts' testimony, and again, I can't validate if that 14-day time frame is accurate or what it's based on, but they both agreed that that is a reasonable estimate of the half-life of the M3 metabolite. It would be virtually impossible. Not virtually impossible. It would be mathematically impossible for any of it to be detectable, let alone for John to have tested positive those 3 times at the amounts he did or at any other amount.
Just want to read you something that I passed over earlier that I think is important. When Nowitzki and Dana appeared for that initial announcement, he said the following, quote, "There's been no violation of the anti-doping program. He's been cleared to fight. In terms of the USADA program, USADA fully analyzed it internally. They reached out to outside experts from around the world. They reached out to another sports league that has seen the same issue. All of them, independent of us, determined that this was not a reingestion of the substance and this very, very small amount that was occurring and still showing up, according to these experts from around the world, did not provide any performance-enhancing benefit." What experts from around the world? The only three experts that he cited and that Raimondi put in his article are Eichner, who used to work with USADA, Bowers, who used to work with USADA, and Fedoric, the current gentleman who works with USADA. That's it. So I don't know who the around the world people were. I don't know if they didn't want to submit letters. I don't know. But that kind of threw me off when I saw who actually backed up the argument that this could still be in the system this much longer, contradicting the Rodchenkov study. Also, a couple of things that he mentioned from the code that I thought were interesting. He mentioned a double jeopardy argument that Section 10.7.4.1 is a double jeopardy provision that, you know, prohibits you from being, like, tried a second time for the same thing. It actually doesn't. It doesn't pertain to that. What it pertains to is when you have two violations and the athlete has not been notified. I'll read it to you just so there's no questions. Quote, "For purposes of imposing sanctions under Article 10.7, a violation will only be considered a second violation if USADA can establish that the athlete committed the second violation after they receive notice, et cetera, et cetera." And then it says, if USADA cannot establish this, the violation shall be considered together, et cetera. So what that means is if you fail two tests and they don't notify you of the first failure before the second failure, they can't try them as two separate failures. They have to try them together. That's not what happened here at all. That provision doesn't even apply. What happened here was he was charged, went to arbitration, served his sentence, and is back. So that's irrelevant. He also brought up John's substantial assistance. Actually, Rogan brought it up and asked him because, of course, some people are questioning. I don't know if Rogan was this was in his mind, but some people could reasonably wonder, like, is John getting special treatment because he's providing assistance? We already know he got a significant reduction, I believe 30 months, off his potential sentence for substantial assistance. And Rogan asked Nowitzki about that. And he actually raised the idea that maybe John shared info on how to use a drug. Again, that would be completely inconsistent with the code, Section 10.6.1.1. The two provisions that talk about this, both of them mention that you have to basically bring forward an anti-doping violation by another person, or you have to bring forward a criminal offense or the breach of professional rules, again, committed by another person. So it's not like you can rat on yourself. It's not like you can give information like, hey, here's how you use this. No, it involves other people. Another thing I found interesting when this was announced is a lot of the websites said that there was, and they put it in quotes, an atypical finding. That is also inaccurate, and I think I know why it was done, but 7.2 of the code, 7.2.1, deals with review of atypical findings, and it says that in some circumstances, laboratories are directed to report the presence of prohibited substances, which may also be produced endogenously as atypical findings, i.e. as findings that are subject to further investigation. If something is produced endogenously, it means it's produced in the human body. So testosterone, for example. So maybe if the testosterone levels seemed odd, it would require further investigation. Oral turinabol and the M3 metabolite are not produced endogenously, so this would not even apply. I believe it's an adverse finding, and that would dictate not further investigation, but that would dictate, I believe, a doping violation. So I think, you know, that's why that semantic game was played. Last but not least, he also made the comment with Rogan and in the scrum that microdosing would not be at play here because you generally only microdose endogenous substances. Again, substances that are produced in the human body. That is not accurate. If you go back to Rodchenkov, when he was doing the doping program in Russia, he created a Russian cocktail, in essence, called the Duchess. And it contained a mix of alcohol extracts of Anavar, Primobolan, and Parabolan. And he actually tested it with whiskey to see how fast it would get out of the system. And that exit period was reliably 3 to 5 days. So, and those substances are obviously not produced in the body. Czech drops, which are also sometimes referred to as Mybolarone, are also sometimes micro. It's just, you can microdose anything. It's just taking a very small dose in the hope that it exits quickly so that it is not detected. And you can do that with an exogenous substance or an endogenous substance. So I don't agree with that either. All right. Last but not least, we're going to move on to the California State Athletic Commission and the Nevada State Athletic Commission and the way that this was all handled and unfolded. So here's what I find utterly indefensible. The Nevada State Athletic Commission, which was sanctioning UFC 232, fight was announced no later than October 11th, because I found a story about it as of that date, so early October, was not given any of this information about John's positive drug tests, plural, until early December. Now, keep in mind, he failed one. He was positive in August. He was positive in September. And they were testing him. They tested him in September, then on October 2nd and 11th. The fight had been announced by then for Nevada, and on November 14th, before the December 9th test. They never told Nevada. USADA never went to Nevada and said, hey, the fighter in the championship main event of a card that you are sanctioning, we are in the process of following up on two positive tests and continuing to test him. Here's what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. You would think, had they done that, that if Nevada was comfortable with the way this all panned out, the fight would have stayed there. But USADA never went to them and told them until early December. There is just no defense for that in my mind. And look, I might be wrong, but I thought I remembered something. I don't know if it's something that Nevada passed or if it's just protocol or whatever, that once a jurisdiction takes jurisdiction over the card, for lack of a better word, that all this information, any independent drug testing, has to be shared with them. That's clearly not what happened from the looks of things, and you would have to think if it did, and they were comfortable with the evidence and had the opportunity to consider it at a full hearing, which California decided they didn't need, that the fight, if it was appropriate, could have stayed in Nevada. And I will give this athletic commission tremendous credit and props in this circumstance, because Dana White said this was going to be a $6 million gate. I believe that the athletic commission gets 5% of that. That's $300,000 for their coffers. More importantly, perhaps, the city of Las Vegas took a beating here. Like, you have to think that the economic impact of a New Year's Eve weekend card in Vegas with 15,000 to 18,000 fans the impact New Year's weekend has to be $20 to $30 million when you consider hotels, shopping, dining, shows, gambling. And that all upped and left because Nevada was never kept in the loop and then got this shoved in front of them at the last minute. And I have spoken to commissioners over the years, and the majority of the work is done by a week before the fight. So I would argue that between medicals and licensing and all the stuff that they have to go through, approving fights, the whole deal, they already basically earn their money. And it all goes away because nobody was telling them anything? That's ridiculous. Ridiculous. And then on top of it, we find out that the California State Athletic Commission, when John went in front of them December 11th to get relicensed, was never told at that time that he had at least two, because I don't know if the test results were back from the December 9th one, but he had at least two positive tests for the very same metabolite that they took his license away for earlier. Nowitzki said, no, they didn't know. Nevada knew at that time, but California didn't. I mean, in hindsight, maybe they should have told them. I'm definitely a proponent in as much transparency as possible. Unfortunately, how do you think of every scenario? What? Like the scenario that a fighter is going to get relicensed in front of the same commission that took his license away based on a failed test for the M3 metabolite. It was really a lot of thought to think, well, they really should have the information that he's had these two failed tests after that. That's a tough one. I mean, seriously, man, this is like bizarro world, okay? And then he says, basically, that California could take it because they had already kind of, you know, worked through the whole, they had the luxury of being familiar with M3 and oral tarinabol, and they didn't need to get up to speed on it. Well, that's not true either, because when they had the M3 tarinabol in front of them in February, the issue wasn't, could this M3 metabolite pop you 500 days later? Issues of pulsing, this thing that, like, no one's ever heard of, that wasn't put in front of them. None of these things were put in front of them because that wasn't the issue. The issue then was, it was a failed test. And the bigger issue, based on the expert testimony, was, do you think it was a contaminated supplement? Do you think it was on purpose? Different. But I suspect, based on the way Andy Foster's handled this, that he wouldn't have cared. Because he took the fight on short notice from Nevada. Basically had, he said in an interview that the letter from Eichner was persuasive to him because he put there was no new evidence and that that was a definitive statement from Eichner. Okay. He also made two other stipulations. One, that John had to submit to VADA testing, which of course wasn't really going to be too relevant for this fight because it was only a week before the fight. And then thirdly, that he had to go and do, he had to come to California and do a drug test, which he did. And we find out from the Raimondi article that the test was done at a lab called Korva, K-O-R-V-A Labs, which is not WADA certified. So a few things jump out at me about this. The first is, if you're Andy Foster and you have this very controversial situation on your hands that doesn't have great optics, and you have the WADA certified lab sitting at UCLA right in Los Angeles, why would you have John tested at a non-WADA certified lab? That's the first thing. But here's the kicker. And this is the part that just has me shaking my head. The CEO of Corva Labs, according to CorvaLabs.com, is none other than Paul Scott. Now, if that name sounds familiar, it's because I told you earlier that Mr. Scott was John Jones' paid expert at his hearing in February of 2018 in front of the California State Athletic Commission with Andy Foster sitting 10 feet away from him while he testified. That wasn't 10 years ago, like maybe you forgot who he was. It was 10 months ago. Let that sink in for just a minute. With all the labs available, including a WADA-certified lab at UCLA less than 10 miles from the venue, why have John tested or even accept a test from the one lab where John had a financial slash expert relationship with the CEO? Scott testified under oath at the hearing in early 18 that he was paid $395 per hour for his time working on John's case. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. Mr. Scott may be the greatest guy ever. His lab could be the greatest non-WADA certified lab to ever test a sample. Don't care. Because I would think, in any case, let alone a situation where an entire fight card is moved by the biggest promotion in the entire sport because a main event fighter has numerous positive test results, and another commission won't let him fight without a hearing, big red flag there, wouldn't you want whatever lab that tests that sample to be 1,000% independent in every way of that fighter? So there's no chance of any appearance of any conflict of interest or anything that could be interpreted as being anything less than 1,000% impartial, independent, and removed from John. Again, Mr. Scott and Corva may be the best in the business. It doesn't matter. In this case, in this set of circumstances, should have been the last lab in America that John should have been sent to or that Foster accepted a sample from. He just worked for John's team 10 months before. It is mind-blowing. All right, with that, we are going to wrap up this edition of the MMA Pep Talk. I want to say in closing, again, I will reiterate that I do not have any opinion on whether John took anything intentionally, by accident, by contaminated stuff. I have no idea how the turinabol and M3 metabolite made it into his system. None. What I do know is that he had three positive tests in 2018 for the M3 metabolite. My review of everything I shared with you leads me to the opinion, and it's just my opinion, that that M3 metabolite would not have been from an ingestion 17 months before. And that's the conclusion I draw to. You can look at the stuff I put forward in this hour, you can look at other things out there, and you can come to whatever conclusion and whatever opinion you see fit. Power to you. Everyone has an opinion, and this one is mine. I want to give a big shout-out and thanks on Twitter to @DimSpace. Whoever that is does a tremendous job of following the anti-doping arena and keeping track of a lot of things. So a great source if you're interested in this type of subject matter. And with that, I also want to wish the Truth Army and each and every one of you a fantastic and happy new year and 2019. I also want to express my appreciation to everybody who listens to me, communicates with me, and enjoys the work that I do and supports the work that I do. So thank you very much. And with that, I will say once again, Happy New Year, and that's a wrap.